Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Thursday, August 21st, 2003. Today's session is entitled, What Do We Do When Natural and Human Needs Collide? Session 4 of Humans in the Natural Environment, presented by Rose McKenney, number MCR 2003-04. Let's listen in.
Discussions about humans in the environment, and since healing the world is one of the summer, is the summer theme, I thought this would be good. My name is Rose McKenney. I work at Pacific Lutheran University, and I wanted to discuss today what we do when, or actually I wanted to, for you to discuss today what we do when natural and human needs collide. Part of my goal is just to get us thinking about some of the things we may not see on a daily basis, even though we use pieces of them. And I have two things I'd like to discuss. We'll start with the first one, which I want to talk about climate change a little bit, and then we'll see how that goes. If we have time, we'll get into some issues on water. As the slide sort of depicts. In case you're curious, the two pictures on this slide are Celilo Falls in the Columbia River and then the Dalles Dam, which flooded the Celilo Falls on the Columbia River. So the Celilo Falls was a natural waterfall upstream of Portland, but still between the Oregon-Washington border area. So before the Columbia, if you're going upstream, heads up through Washington. One of the things, there's a lot of different evidence for that can be used to indicate that the climate of the world is changing right now. One of the major ones that causes a lot of concern among geologists is that glaciers are melting, and the temperatures records that we've been keeping on land show that the temperature on land has been rising, that we've probably experienced about a 1 to 2 degree global average temperature increase on land in the last century. So that's one of the pieces of information of concern, and there are some questions about exactly why that is. And one of the things that we do know from a variety of geologic evidence, but the strongest of that actually comes from the ice cores that have been taken out of Greenland and Antarctica, is that when we have higher levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the Earth temperature is usually higher. And I'm talking not about a local temperature, but the Earth as a whole. And one of the things that we know is that there are a variety of things that affect the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. One is the formation of rocks and then the breakdown of rocks. So that's the rock and weathering cycle. And that actually operates on a very, very long time scale. Of millions to billions of years. So as volcanoes erupt, they pour carbon dioxide out into the atmosphere. As rocks weather, the carbon and rocks are formed, another type of rocks are formed, the carbon dioxide is used, so it's released during the weathering cycle. It's also taken up during rock formation and released during other rock cycle rock formation. If you want to know the detailed chemistry of that, I'll be happy to discuss it at some other time. Because we could spend an entire class on that. I mean, not an hour, but an entire class on just rock chemistry. And then there's also the biological cycling. And it seems to be mostly in the ocean, though there's also the forests use a lot of carbon. That's where we get the wood and the trees is locking in the carbon from the atmosphere. The ocean also locks in a lot of carbon. And every so often, it gets indigestion and it burps and releases a chunk of carbon dioxide. And in addition to that, there's a natural, a slower cycling. And that takes place over hundreds of thousands of years.
What's a burp?
A burp? Well, it's sort of, what I mean by a burp is like when we burp, a huge chunk of gas comes out.
Uh-huh.
And the ocean actually does that too. Mm-hmm. Occasionally.
What's it called, geologically?
You know, I don't know that.
Ocean burp?
No. The CO2 ocean burp. No, it's actually a release of a large amount of gas. We don't have a specific, you know, nice name for it.
Oh.
And I just always call it burping. It's there's enough pressure from the gas that it's released rather rapidly.
So when you're announcing things on the surface per se, or
okay, it actually is. It's like unscrewing the top off your soda can and your soda bottle, and you get bubbles starting to form. And your question was,
it's not from volcanism.
Not necessarily. Sometimes it's just a case of the pressure has there's enough gas build up and there's enough agitation that it's released. There was a lake that in the Cameroon,
mm-hmm. yeah.
where
yeah.
the gas built up, and that was volcanic. So it can happen from volcanoes, where the volcano is giving enough CO2 off over time in the lake, and it actually built up a very high pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And then the lake's normally the water turns over. In this case, this one did not. And all of a sudden, it turned over all at once. The CO2 came out, rolled down the hill, and all the people downhill died. I wasn't gonna go into volcanic hazards today, but that thank you too. Human actions, on the other hand, are changes in carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere have taken place since the Industrial Revolution mostly. So we're talking a century to decade sort of scale. And we actually, our current economy is based on fossil fuels. Right off the top of my head, and I'm not an economist, but I can't really think of very many things that we do that don't rely on burning with fossil fuels, except sometimes in a few small places. Like the Northwest has a large amount of electricity that does not come from fossil fuel burning. Most of the rest of the country, however, the electricity comes from coal and gas and diesel generators. We have a tendency to think that what we need today is the most important. In fact, that's actually built into our economy. However, when we're talking about climate change, and this, what I'm going to read, it comes from one of my teachers, actually, one of my professors at Penn State, who is a world-class researcher and an absolutely phenomenal teacher to boot. And I'm just going to read you a little bit out of a book called The 2 Mile Time Machine, which is actually about glacial ice, which is what he does research on. But this, what I'm going to read you, is actually his view of why we should be concerned about, or one of the things that we should be concerned about when we talk about global warming, or the human effect of climate change. Issues of fairness also come into play. Climate change may hurt most people on Earth, but the fossil fuel burning that contributes to climate change now is benefiting some people, those in the developed world who do most of the burning, more than others, those in the developing world. These are important questions and deserve careful scrutiny. Okay, and I think that really ties into the healing of the world and the importance of knowing what our actions are. And then in addition to that, if we want to just think about our own economy here, we tend to think of our coastlines as fixed and our infrastructure as being pretty strong. But in fact, in geologic time, and I'm going to scoot my way up through, excuse me. On the East Coast, it's not such a big deal on the West Coast because the land is pretty steep. But on the East Coast, over the last 5 million years, the coastline has come this far inland and been this far offshore, depending on how much water is tied up in glacial ice. Okay? And right now, what's happening is that glacial ice is melting. And as the glacial ice melts, well, the highest point in Florida is just about 300 feet above sea level. There's not a whole lot of room there for Florida to remain economically viable should we have a lot of ice melt. Does anyone know how long it takes for climate to change? I mean, what do you think in terms of how long this actually takes?
Yeah. Well, it used to be thought that it took a very long period of time, but now I guess the current thinking is that it takes as little as several decades.
Yeah, when I was growing up, we thought, you know, really fast would be centuries. So it's not a big deal with inside. And you're close. But actually, one of the things they found,
Well, I seem to remember reading something about finding these woolly mammoths flash frozen. They've got stuff in them already. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like there is some sort of a heat exchange method that runs from the equator up to the more temperate latitude. If you stop that, you can get a rapid change, rapid cooling.
Yeah, and actually, I've heard everything from as little as 3 years, not for glaciers to advance, that takes quite a while, but for the temperature conditions to change. Mm-hmm. So, sort of conservatively, a lot of times now we're saying about a decade. And that's well within our view of what could be a problem in terms of our...
Yeah. When you say change, what would constitute that change within a decade? Can you give us an example?
We're talking of changes of the global average temperature on the order of like about 4 degrees Celsius.
That's huge.
And it's only 4 degrees, no big deal. But the average across the entire Earth, that's a lot. Yeah, that's a lot of heat. That's a lot of temperature change. And it sort of has to make you pause and consider we rely on certain areas of this country to produce certain types of food. And that's just the temperature change we're talking about. There's even more uncertainty in terms of where water will be. And that, I've seen for the center part of this country, everything from, well, it's going to get warmer and drier to cooler and wetter, you know, all the possibilities when they're trying to figure out what might happen if there's a change in carbon dioxide. So there's some real uncertainty in terms of water, which of course we know we need for food growth, which we have to have. Here's my question to you, or sort of my statement is, we have a huge amount of evidence that points toward warming the Earth. There is some evidence that points in the other direction as well. But, you know, we have a lifestyle, I would say personally I'm sort of on autopilot when it comes to what I do on a daily basis. And the economy is based on burning of fossil fuels. Changing that's going to be really difficult. A lot of people, and I would say particularly at the moment, a lot of people in the current federal government level would say, don't worry about it. Economics, classic economics says, don't really worry about it. If you have what you need today, it's really not worth as much in the future. But we really don't know. And fear that it might be a very, very large change when we're absolutely certain that change is happening. So, what do you think we should do? Yes?
We think we probably should drive a Festiva. I do.
Okay, so we actually do have some things that are well within our choices to make, and that's what car do you drive? And does that car meet your needs but not really exceed them? I don't have a Ford Festiva.
Or even how many cars do you have?
How many cars do you have? Do you remember the days of, you know, a family of four or six and they had one car?
Yes.
They also only had one person working.
That's true too. And so,
and we only have one car. We have two people working. Let me tell you, this economy is not set up for one car.
It certainly isn't set up for public transportation, which would be a step in the right direction.
One of the most exciting things is telecommuting. People being able to work from home, and then I commute to work twice a week now, work from home 3 days a week.
Right.
I'm thinking about buying one of these electric hybrid vehicles so I can get 60 miles a gallon.
Right.
You haven't tried those cars. They're wonderful.
I have not, but I do know of them.
My neighbors own two. Mm-hmm. They're silent. Number one, my favorite thing about them is they're quiet. Number two, they get almost 100 miles or so per gallon of gas they burn. The third thing is, I always thought they were wimpy cars, but he says, no, the third, you're going over the mountain pass, we've got two engines, two power sources.
Mm-hmm. Electric and gas.
Mm-hmm. And we blow over it. And so you don't have, it doesn't have quite the acceleration, but it sure has the power in the long haul.
What's the price tag?
They're pricey. They're around $40,000.
No, they're actually not.
The new Honda Civic, I just priced this. The new Honda Civic is $18,000. And in Virginia, you get a $2,000 tax break. And you get to ride in the SUV lane. Or the HOV lane. There are people proposing an SUV lane. The new generation is really quite
great. I have to admit that I wish I had needed a car about 3 years ago, because I do own a Honda Civic, but it's the classic Honda Civic. So we have new technologies that will help us with our car addiction, and there are, as the technology increases, the options in some cases to commute to work. But then there's other questions about, wouldn't it be nice if we had the ability to use mass transit the way many Europeans use mass transit? Some cities have moved that way. The one I know the most about is Portland. Although the population has increased by about 25%, their use of fossil fuel, their carbon dioxide emissions has dropped by about 80%. And I can't remember whether, I think that's about a 10-year period. So, and you know it's not because cars have changed that much. Everybody in Portland is driving a hybrid. Well, I know that because I've been down there recently. So there are ways to set up cities and plan carefully.
Don't discount the fact that the cars have become considerably cleaner than they were. I mean, nowadays, the cars run at 1/10 the amount of emissions that they were running 10 years ago.
That's true.
That's CO2, though.
But isn't it true that SUVs don't have those standards in their cars?
Yeah. The SUVs aren't under car standards. They're under another set of standards.
One of the things that Portland did when they set up their plan was to limit the number of parking spaces that would be downtown. They actually removed parking spaces from the downtown area and to encourage mass transit. And there's a big crush between, you know, if you want to drive down to town, there's limited parking. And it's starting, the price of parking is starting to go up because of that. They can charge a little more. But it's also encouraged people to get onto mass transit in order to get downtown. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the main reasons it went down, is it gotten the cars off the road.
In a large city, that would work, but it would kill downtown Bellingham.
No, probably.
Mm-hmm. So there's a certain city size that's needed, but we do have quite a few of those, and I would guess that there are quite a few that don't have that same decrease. In fact, to sort of answer the question about the car, it is true that the cars have become more efficient. During that same period of time, I think it's Atlanta, Georgia, has had a similar population increase, slightly more, and their carbon dioxide emissions have gone up, not by a huge amount, but slightly. So my guess is the fact that their carbon dioxide emissions have not gone up is that signal from the more efficient cars, but the decrease in Portland is an additional removal of the cars from.
In a lifestyle area too, I mean, how much driving you do has a big effect on that. If you have as much driving, you're going to generate half as much emission.
Right.
And people that, you know, find they have to drive 30 or 40 or 50 miles to work each day, or have to make a dozen trips to hear the hither and yon, mm-hmm. have essentially chosen to be more polluting.
Right. And we all make a choice of both where we live relative to where we work.
Well, sometimes we don't make that choice. Sometimes it's just an economic reality that you can't live very close to where you work because you just can't afford to live there.
Well, yeah.
Or you work for a company like Boeing, where you may start working near where you live. A year later, you're up in Everett.
Yeah. I actually worked for Senator Gore for 5 years as his science advisor, and I arranged about 30 or 40 hearings on global warming. And one of the most interesting ones was on new technologies. And the point that one of the speakers made was that typically about a third of our energy goes for cars and transportation and trucks, about a third goes for industrial processes, and about a third goes for residential and, you know, housing, heating your homes. And there are huge efficiencies to be gained there that we just don't notice. You know, we can measure the miles per gallon in cars. Companies certainly watch how much money they're spending on energy. But most of us don't realize that you can cut your heating bill by a third or half with relatively small investments. And there are new technologies that are helping that as well. That's one place that we do a lot more.
Okay, and specifically, what kinds of things can you do?
Just put insulation, proper double-paned windows, some of the new passive solar designs. I was in Switzerland this summer, and they were suffering through a terrible heat wave. But most of the buildings do not have air conditioning. Instead, they have passive systems built in. They actually have these computer-controlled shades. So you'll have shades on the outside of the windows that will come down when the temperature gets above a certain temperature, and they'll close for you and shade the building to make sure that it's 15 degrees cooler inside the building than outside, without air conditioning.
Something as simple as changing your furnace. We just changed over to a 95% efficient furnace from a 62%. So there's a 30% savings in, while we're still burning gas, we're not burning as much. Mm-hmm. And it is truly amazing. The exhaust comes out, it's just a white cloud of vapor. It is nothing but carbon dioxide and water.
Air conditioning is the same thing.
Yeah.
About a lot of 30 to 40 year old air conditioners.
Yeah. You can hold your hand right in it. It's just plastic pipe. So the efficiency of return on that is very
high. It produces less other emissions as well.
In Seattle, one newspaper reporter realized that the city light electrical bills were a matter of public record. And so he found the 10 highest residential users in the city of Seattle. And these people were using 10 to 20 times as much electricity as the average house.
They were growing marijuana in the basement.
One of them that he got to talk to said, well, the reason we're using so much is we have to leave the door open all the time so the dog can get in and out of the house.
Okay, well, yeah, and actually...
a dog door is not that expensive.
Yeah, and a dog door would probably cut that down a bit. And one of the things that we can tell if we look at heat use patterns is that there are a lot of buildings that just literally leak heat out. It's sort of like trying to heat if you had a house made out of a sieve. And so just knowing that, you should go through and double check the doors and the windows and make sure that your house is in good shape. Another thing, if you happen to be in the market to buy a new house or to build a house, has anyone been down to Zion and seen the interpretive center down there? Mm-hmm. And I was down there, and it's just wonderful what they've done. Of course, it's a very hot place. And they've designed the building so that it will get maximum heating from the sun in the wintertime and minimal heating from the sun just by the design of the angle of the roof and the windows.
Zion
National Park.
Yeah.
That's what the Indians did. The Anastasi Indian dwellings, if you look at them carefully, you can see that they catch the wind, the sun in the winter, and overhang protects them in the summer.
Mm-hmm. This is also an economic issue, because all of us, I probably can afford these things. People who are on the edge or the margins are renting for $500 a month that's like half their income. They can't afford to do these things, and perhaps some of us are landlords and have to consider our rental properties in that equation.
There are lots of amazingly inefficient subsidies in the system. Part of it's zoning. Yeah. The problem that we have with suburban sprawl is that you zone in the neighborhood so that you have five houses to an acre, and as a result, people have to commute 40 miles. We have incredible inefficiencies in our tax systems for oil and gas.
You bring up something I'd like to just briefly throw out. There's this whole American dream of owning your own home. And if you want to own your own home and have a large piece of property, then it actually, you need to be very careful about the rest of the decisions you make, because you're looking at probably driving, in many areas, driving a long way into work, or having a variety of other things. And my students in my environmental studies class said, well, we really have to have, planned communities with high density housing and green space so that we have, the runoff and all the energy concerns are taken care of. And I looked at them and I said, okay, fine. You're all somewhere between 21 and, say, 37. How many of you really want to live there? How many of you have always dreamed of having your very own apartment? And some people do, and I know too that then we discussed the whole idea of maybe having sort of a life cycle of housing, where you grow up in a house, and then as you get older, well, you really don't want to take care of a whole house, and so you move into a planned community. But we still had this issue of what we valued, as a group of people, what we valued in terms of environment and what we valued in terms of what we really wanted for ourselves were sort of at odds. I don't think that any of us in the room had really thought about it until we hit the point where we decided that having a lot more housing coming into our watershed was not a good idea unless it was very carefully planned. So those are some of the issues. Anything else we should do? We've discussed what we can do on an individual level with transportation, what we can do in terms of housing fixes, and maybe some considerations about design should you be planning a new house. Anything else?
You know, getting back to transportation, I'm kind of surprised that there hasn't been a bigger push towards the electric car. The only reason I mention that is because there is a manager in my building that owns an electric Toyota RAV4, which is just a kick. And this thing, even though it was kind of expensive, I think it was 28 grand for him to purchase, after the tax rebates and things like that. But this thing runs him exactly $1.50 a day to drive 90 miles, 45 to work and 45 back. And he's allowed to use the HOV lanes. And this thing is quiet. It needs virtually no maintenance whatsoever. What surprises me is that Toyota has discontinued it, and Honda is thinking about discontinuing their electric vehicle production altogether, if they haven't already. And so, I mean, considering how clean this thing is, Edison's been using these things for years, and I mean, they get 150,000 miles out of the batteries and don't have to do a thing to the dog.
Well, you have
in Virginia, the Hondas sell out the minute they get the lots.
You have an issue here, though, that as nice as I'll play devil's advocate for a little bit here. As nice as the electric cars are, if you're a family, two kids, two dogs, whatever, you've got a moderate house, and you have a budget for a car, and you have a choice between a gasoline-powered Honda Civic that'll run anywhere from 18,000 to 22,000, give or take a little bit, and you have a choice of an electric car that's 35,000. Mm-hmm. What are you going to choose?
I mean, the economic trade-off.
We can all be green-minded as possible,
but in reality, I mean, you've got to
come to the end of the month, and you got to pay the car payment.
Right.
You still have to do what you can afford.
The good news is things are getting a lot cheaper, a lot quicker. So it's pretty. If the companies stay committed to it, I think they'll have the volumes to actually meet the need and provide an affordable alternative.
There's a lot more people who want them.
There's an SUV version coming out, which apparently is going to sell like hotcakes.
But still, an electric car is not free of emissions. It's just different. I mean, you're still getting CO2 from it because somewhere that electricity has to be generated.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the hybrids actually are gasoline cars.
Yeah.
And they have an electric motor, which is
but you
charged by the gas.
You still have to develop the power plant in order to generate the additional electricity.
Well, for a pure electric car, that's true. For the hybrids.
Even in the hybrids?
No, the hybrids generate their own electricity.
They don't plug in.
But they're still running on gasoline.
So. Yeah. Right, they are.
But half as much. So the hybrids, you don't have to plug in.
Right.
Because I was wondering about that, because in most parts of the country, the electricity is...
Some parts of the country don't lend themselves to the same kinds of rapid transit solutions.
90%
of the country. It's nice to talk about rapid transit, but when you come to Southern California, our rapid transit is a 20-year-old diesel-burning bus that is maintained just like any other government entity, and will just barf out all sorts of particulate matter. And a handful of people ride them because they're not attractive to ride. You don't ride them unless you absolutely have to. In Southern California, we can't do subways. As I don't know anybody here who wants to be underground when it starts to shake. It's a kind of a scary thing, even when you're outside. But what we end up getting, at least in Southern California, we've had this one project that came in, and a politician patted themselves very heavily on the back for getting this government money to come in. Well, they built about a 22-mile stretch of subway that serves about 11,000 people a day. That's it, and it was billions to put it underground. Mm-hmm. the politician wasn't thinking about transit. The politician was thinking about how much money can I preserve in my district and get myself reelected.
It's the biggest problem with fixed mass transit, unless you're in a heavy corridor or an area that can feed into a single line. It's inflexible, and with those billions, you could have had brand new buses spreading out to all the neighborhoods everywhere.
Okay.
Just another quick aspect to this. What we do in the U.S. is important, but it's going to be dwarfed by what's happening in India and China right now. China's got four times as many people, and if they go in one path, we'll have a hope of at least decreasing the increase rate of CO2. If they go down another path and follow the American model, it doesn't matter what we do. I mean, they've got four times as many people as we do, and unfortunately this present administration doesn't seem to be working with other countries to help them get the technology.
And their claim is that we had cheap but dirty power to build up our country. We're telling them they should use expensive power,
right,
and not be able to build theirs up as fast. They have an argument there.
They have an argument based on the history, and but what I'd like to do is, if we could, is focus on what we can do. And we've discussed a couple of different things, transportation and housing. Is there any other section that we should really look at? Yes?
Well, I would argue that we can do something about China if we push our leaders to take. I mean, this is a high leverage thing. I mean, $a few million can educate a lot of Chinese engineers.
And she's behind you too. Go ahead.
Recreation activities. And I keep thinking of a friend of mine who has a large boat. He puts $100 worth of diesel in it on the weekend, and these little wave riders that are two-cycle things that are very inefficient, put a whole bunch of that's just their choice, and the RV out into the woods, and then take their little off-country bikes and go places, or run snowmobiles through the whatever. Their choice of recreation is fossil fuel intensive, and I mean, I am a boater also. I got a sailboat. But it takes a little bit of my brother-in-law gives me a hard time about it because I use my SUV to get to the sailboat. But nevertheless, it was a conscious choice. And I can go out for a weekend and I don't put $100 into the fuel tank and have a good time. So I think recreation is something that we should look at, because I think that's also, if that's what you like to do and you feel good about it, it can come back over into a conscious way of that you do everything. I mean, this is fun, this is exciting, this is what I want to do. And it becomes easier to incorporate a lifestyle.
Not Carol?
Excuse me, Carol's been waiting.
This is back to the home again, but I think your personal habits at home can make a big difference. Like in the winter time in Western Washington, to be sure, I open my window in my bedroom, shut off the heat to the whole house generally, and shut my bedroom door so that the rest of the house doesn't lose all of its heat. And yet, I'm not running in heat at all most of the time. And things like putting on a sweater or throwing on a napkin instead of turning up the thermostat. I shut off my, like before I came here, I shut down my water heater. And the inconvenience is minor when I get home. Except unless I forget that I shut it off. Right. I have wine before now.
The thing I was going to say is probably every single one of us can do is replace a two-cycle motor with any four-cycle motor.
That's right.
The pollution equivalent of a two-cycle motor is roughly equal to four or five cars running full time. So when you go out and mow your lawn with a two-cycle motor, you're polluting as much as four or five guys driving all day.
That's what
four-cycle is much more efficient.
One of the things when we're talking about China and when we're talking about our recreation choices that comes to my mind is sort of the overwhelming power of the advertising industry in this country and how we're so driven by what we see and hear that we just have to have. Gotta have it. And we can choose very carefully to make the lower emissions choice, but if you're still going out and consuming a lot, then you're still adding in a less significant way to a problem, but part of it is driven by what we think we have to have. I'm as guilty as the next person. Some people have said, you're awfully arrogant. So, no. The finger's pointing right here first at me. But we live in a country where it's so easy to want so many things. Partly because of what we see on a daily basis.
Have you subscribed to Adbuster magazine yet?
I've seen it.
It's great.
Yeah, it is.
Anecdote for
which magazine?
Adbuster.
Adbuster.
It makes you, after you read one issue, you are properly skeptical about all the stuff.
Right.
Trying to sell you.
All right.
Very good.
I was going to mention that your lifestyle of how you consume things makes a difference too, because at least in our town, a lot of stuff that goes to landfill is burned. And the garbage issue is a big one, because in a lot of places they burn it. They have to burn some types, and so how you use things in your house, how you buy packaging, that makes a difference too. So not just buying stuff, but how is it packaged?
Recycling. And actually, very recently at PLU, we had Anthony Cortese came to talk. And I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's the head of Second Nature. It's out of Boston. And he said that the mantra, rather than reduce, reuse, recycle, should be refuse, should be the first R, so that refuse, reduce, recycle should be the three R's in the current day and age.
Dump half your mailbox out before.
I would be perfectly happy if half of my mailbox didn't come to me. I would be happy to move on if people are ready to leave this topic, and I'm just going to, what I have for the next couple, this was, as you said, the hybrids, and this is actually the Honda. This is the center of the city of Portland, buying less stuff. By the way, the clothes are up there for the women. We have a tendency to buy a lot of clothes. The electronics are up there for the men. They have a tendency to buy a lot more electronics. And if, just in case you're interested, one of the things that Europe has gone to different is they're taxing waste. So they tax things like solid waste disposal, emissions, and it's a way to build into the tax code to keep people from a pig tax would be a good way of putting it. And just if you're curious, there's the breakdown of where our waste goes after we've recycled in this country, and 32% of it is still paper.
But we can't quit those magazines and junk food. We don't want it.
At one time there was an address that you could write to, and I suspect it still exists. I unfortunately do not have it. You can write and ask to be pulled off of all junk mailing addresses.
Actually, you can get that from the post office.
Okay.
You can also go to the Direct Marketing Association website, and they have it all set up for that.
So there are ways to get that endless stream of junk mail to stop coming. Okay, so our next little issue is more of a local one, though I've framed it in a more local terms, though it is a concern throughout the country. We do a lot to our rivers. For example, on the left-hand side, that's the Puyallup River, and it has been straitjacketed so that it flows straight for miles, and it actually doesn't move around much. A lot of times, it's to prevent scenes like you see on the right, where we have water flowing over the surface of urban streets and into people's houses. And then in this area, we also have put in a lot of dams. And these dams alter the flow of the amount of river, of the amount of water that comes down a river at a certain time. And it also alters the slope of the river so that there's very still water above the dam, and then you have this crashing huge amount of energy downstream of the dam. When I talk about flow alteration, this is an unregulated or a river without a dam on it. Slight changes over a weekly period. If you were at water yesterday, you saw this. And then here is below a Columbia River dam where we actually have a greater change in a 24-hour period. So there's a change of 100,000 cubic feet per second flow in about a 24-hour period, and the minimum flow is only 60,000. So it's more than double the fluctuation of flow here.
Are they using the Columbia River Dam for hydroelectric generation?
My guess is that this one is. I can't keep track of which ones do which, but the Columbia River dams are dominantly in there for hydroelectric generation. And that this signal is the result of the way we use electricity. The dams have been set up in many places. They're called peaking dams. They produce electricity at the peak need. So the electric generation is meant to match the need rather than just to go with the water supply. And when we talk about salmon, and this is how I sort of couch this is with salmon, because that's one of the big flashpoints in the Northwest. The salmon actually use almost all of the river for various things. They tend to use the upper reaches for spawning and freshwater rearing. So the salmon will spend up to a year as juveniles in the stream system. Then they come down and will actually use the lower reaches, the delta and marsh area, where the water is actually brackish, to go through the change from being a freshwater fish to being a saltwater fish. There are some extreme physiological changes that occur so that they don't, if you drink too much salt water, you will die because the water will literally be pulled out of your body. Well, they suffer from some of the same issues, and so they have to go through physiological changes to adapt before they can go out and live in the salt water. And lest you think this is a new issue, I came across this, and I just about... recently I've learned that it's a very old issue, because you can see that this is Save the Columbia River Salmon, and the date is 1924. I did not make this up. Okay, so this is a very old issue in the Northwest. The changes that we have in the rivers hamper the survival and the migration of salmon. In a legal sense, we have a problem in the Northwest because we have runs that are currently threatened, we have other runs that are endangered, and we have runs that are now extinct. And we're legally required to protect them, and yet there are all these things that, I don't know very many people who are willing to have the electricity pulled out of their house at the moment.
Or have it replaced with an oil-free power plant.
Yeah. So, we don't really want to have to burn fossil fuels because we just decided that that wasn't a good idea. And so now what are we going to do? We have dams. We need to protect our communities from flooding. So how are we going to deal with the issue of also wanting to have large salmon populations?
Well, fishing is a big factor in the salmon population.
Fishing is a big factor, especially that 1924 date is a real clue that.
But you know,
those of you who have remember very large salmon runs from your youth, if you grew up in the Northwest, those were actually already declined from much larger salmon runs because of fishing pressure. But it's not just fishing pressure. So,
well, the Nooksack, which has been declared endangered, has no dams.
Mm-hmm.
It's primarily dairy, it's farming, it's pressures from urban expansion, it's and then diversions for water use in the cities. It's not dams.
I didn't say it was just dams. In fact, I did not start, and that's one of the things I wanted to make clear. I did not start with dams alone.
Is the Nooksack a river?
The Nooksack is a river in the Sound. And
it's the river in Whatcom County.
I'm not saying that this is just the dams. The dams, however, are a factor.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying that they're not a factor, but
yeah.
They're certainly not the only.
Mm-hmm. But
on the other hand, we want our dairy products too.
So rather than pointing fingers at what it is, how do we start to come to a solution where we can have a lifestyle that we would like to have, and yet also have the salmon? And for some of us, like last night, the salmon is a part of the lifestyle that we would like to have, eating it. So how do we go about this? Yes.
Well, they were trying to build some high tension lines along the Columbia River, and BPA wanted to do a study, environmental impact study. Long story short, they determined migratory waterfowl would hit these and die. They turned in their report, and that was that. They didn't have to do anything. They just had to show that yes, there's an environmental impact, and they didn't have to mitigate. I think what we need to do is, if you do one of these things and you see there's an impact, you should figure out some way to mitigate it. In Tillamook County, there's a lot of dairy waste that goes onto the ground. And what they're trying to do there now is collect it. Northwest Natural Gas and PGE collect it, digest it, and make methane gas with it and burn it. Mm-hmm. It goes back into the methane system, and that Northwest Natural Gas has set up. But that's an example of seeing a problem that could be mitigated instead of just saying, okay, yeah, we put X tons on the ground here and just go on there.
Another one is with all the housing that goes on, and some of it's from farming, but it's also from house, you know, just building, is the streams. They go around saving the streams, but they take down too much of the local vegetation. And then they think, oh yeah, you're supposed to plant along the stream, but then they put the wrong kinds of plants in. And what they've been trying to do, at least in Whatcom County, is replant all these streams with the right kind of vegetation, because if your stream gets too hot, little babies die. And so you have to have the shading. And they found if it's the wrong kind of plant, changes the pH of the water, that kills all the babies. So they also, that's something we can do, is go and fix the vegetation around the stream so that there's something for them to live.
And it's a favorite project.
Yeah. Many, many of the streams in the Northwest have their own watershed council. And so if you are interested in something like that, you can join the local watershed council, and then there often will be, hopefully, but there is a book on saving this on stream, the Adopt a Stream Foundation, and then also there are educational programs, so that if you do put the effort up, you should try to be doing it in a way that has been determined, at least for the moment, to be the best possible way of going about restoration. Why I say for the moment is I know enough of the history of salmon restoration that there was a time in the 70s where the best thing for salmon was to pull all of the wood out of the stream and burn it. Now we're very carefully putting it back in the stream and anchoring it to the stream bed so they'll have some place. So one of the things to do is to try to stay current with what is the considered the current best practice. And part of the problem with salmon has been understanding their biology, which is...
Let's play devil's advocate. Let's say there was such an extreme need where we had to basically block off all the rivers for hydroelectric power, and the salmon were to suffer as a result of that. Is there some way that, and you know, speak up if you're an animal, you know, animal person, if you know quite a bit about, you know, how salmon behave. But I mean, it seems to me that salmon would adapt to a change in the ecological environment. And I mean, would it be possible to maybe create a new environment for the salmon to spawn in, as opposed to going upstream? And I mean, is this
feasible? It's called hatcheries.
The hatchery experiment wasn't particularly successful. To answer your question about the biology of salmon, briefly, as much as I know, is that they are very adaptable. They're, in some cases, because they after all come from an environment where there are earthquakes and volcanoes that rapidly change the streams. But the thing is that those changes happen, and then the stream continues to change, and the salmon can survive that kind of a change. When humans change things, the change remains, and we often make it so that everything has been changed, not just one spot.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the issue in terms of salmon biology. There are some salmon who have been landlocked. They do survive. They're called kokanee. And so, yes, they can actually adapt to never going out to sea in some cases.
Look at kokanee salmon in Lake Chelan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and landlocked, mm-hmm. and they're fine. Mm-hmm. So they're very good at adapting, but they apparently have a hard time adapting to all of the pressures that humans have put on them.
I mean, it seems reasonable that we would be able to create some kind of a saltwater solution for them due to the fact that they migrate from saltwater to the freshwater and then back again.
They only spawn in freshwater as part of the problem.
Okay.
But the net pen fish hatcheries have been often unsuccessful, and they're getting better. They've been doing enough experiments that they know that their diet decreases in the winter, so they feed them less in the winter, so the die-off rate's better. But like in Young's Bay near Astoria, they've got Rogue River salmon that they're raising, and they come back really fat because they're programmed to have a long migratory cycle, but it's a real short one. So when they hit Young's Bay, they're great fish.
What about other wildlife? For instance, I was involved in constructing a road, and the major neighborhood concern was the deer crossing and being able to go from neighborhood to neighborhood. So we built this big tunnel under the road, and that nobody uses, but I always keep thinking about that in terms of that's my major experience in animal habitat, kind of trying to make things better. It was a dismal failure.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody got better experiences?
I don't have personally better experiences, but I do know a little bit about, what what they are trying to do. And this is also, the Puyallup River was that very straight stretch that I showed you. In 1996, there were some very large floods in much of the Northwest, and it took out some of the levees and dikes on the Puyallup River, and so they said, well, let's go with this. And they built levees, but they built them out away from the river. So rather than right next to the channel, they have been set back. That's the origin of that. So that the river can now move within an area. And that creates a lot more habitat. It's much more natural. It still allows the people who live in that lower right-hand corner to be fairly secure from floods. And in fact, in many ways, because there's so much area there, it's a much easier engineering task. And so that's one possibility. Now, the big drawback to this is, can you imagine how expensive it is to buy up all that land? Okay. So that's the current problem with it is it's very expensive, and the person who owns the land has to be willing to sell it. And another possibility when we're talking about electricity is that there are a variety of types of geothermal electricity that can be used from the very hot areas around the Cascades, but also in the cooler areas, we can run pipes down into the ground and have a closed loop system and basically have a heat pump system that cools the house in the summer, warms it in the winter, and also as a part of the cooling in the summer produces or heats a lot of the hot water for the house. It requires a well field. And I know that at Pacific Lutheran, the building that they're in the process of constructing, they have put a well field out so that that building will be heated and cooled rather than on the boiler system on the geothermal exchange between the ground and the building itself.
So expensive.
The expense is mostly, and I don't know the answer to that, the expense is mostly in drilling the wells, because once the wells are drilled, and you also have to set aside the piece of ground where the well field is, you can't build on it. It becomes, which in some ways is great, because then it becomes permanent green space. You can have sports on it, you can put some landscaping on it, but you have to be careful of large trees because of the roots getting down into the geothermal system. But you automatically, by doing that, lock in some green space with the development. So that's a possibility. In some areas, if you've been here more than once, you're getting tired of seeing these pictures, there is low-impact development where the water systems can actually, we can actually limit the runoff. That, if you limit the runoff, you tend to limit the flooding problems, and so you don't have to straitjacket the river downstream. That was pretty much, those are some things in addition to the things that other people brought in. And thank you very much for your ideas. I hope as you go back into your communities and your daily life, you think about the impacts. And yes, ma'am.
When you're done, I have a comment at the end.
Okay,
thank you.
That you think about the impacts of your of sort of our daily lives on the environment. And it's not just the environment here. We often don't think about it, but the more urban we become, the more widespread the impacts of our lifestyle become, because we're taking materials from India, from China, and the manufacturing system, and we're actually really quite responsible in many cases for, because of the things we consume, for impacts in other parts of the world. Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to make a plug for the next seminar, which is on domestic violence. Sometimes women think that they're the only ones that should be educated on this, but it has been said that when men get outraged, something might be happening. And this week, Holden Village is hosting and paying for 20 women and children from the shelter. And these are not people with PhDs. hear people who've experienced domestic violence. So I would encourage you to stay and hear a bit about their stories and about the program of YWCA here locally.
When is that?
Right now. 5 o'clock.
That's why they're trying to come in.
Yes,
and that's why they're trying to come in. So thank you very much.
Thank you.